Actually, with my three sons, I didn't go into very much detail because when I was a judge, I would tell them about my cases and about people and some of the problems. And so they followed my example, and one is a geologist, the other one's an artist, and the other one teaches math. So they stayed pretty far away from the legal profession. I want to thank, of course, the friends for inviting me and actually for giving me the opportunity to read this book that I probably wouldn't have read otherwise. And also for all of you who came to hear me give this talk today. I might mention a couple of connections that I thought with the Supreme Court. You know, it's when you really think about how large this country is and how many few cases can ever get to the Supreme Court. We do have one lawyer in Corvallis who's argued a case before the Supreme Court. He happens to be here, Bob Mix in the back. He actually appeared in that August Hall and made an argument on the Corvallis sand and gravel case. And we also, did any of you folks ever know Walt Hopkins, Dorothy Hopkins? Some of you are raising your hand. Well, Walt served in the South Pacific with Justice Stevens, John Paul Stevens. They served together, were friends. And Walt did some volunteer work over the court. That's how I got to know him. And he had actually letters signed by Judge Paul Stevens and had visited him when he was in Washington, D.C. So the book, The Nine, it's a real interesting read. I really enjoyed reading it. I'd call it a light, popular political book. I mean, it's not an academic book. He does have a certain political bias to his writing. I think you picked that up fairly early. It's pretty obvious. But he is very interesting, and I think everybody can enjoy it. I read a number of reviews, magazine reviews, New York Times reviews, and the one I think that I would sort of agree with most is the one from the Christian Science Monitor. And that, just quoting in part, there are times in The Nine when Tubin reveals more about his own legal and political preferences than would be the case in a strictly objective account of the inner workings of the High Court. Readers who share the author's left-of-center outlook will likely delight in his account. Others looking for a more nuanced, politically neutral analysis may have to search elsewhere, as will many conservatives. This book covers the last 15 years, basically, of the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. And one thing he says that is interesting, I mean, I think you picked this up from reading the book, but I want to take a little quote from the book right here, right at the outset, because this is going to come up time and time again. He says the following. This is a sort of a quote from the New York Times. The first sentence is a quote from the New York Times book review. In the end, Mr. Tobin concludes that when it comes to incendiary political issues, and we know what they are, gun control, abortion, death penalty, then here's the quote. The identity of the justices on the court matters more than the quality of the arguments. There is, for example, no meaningful difference between Scalia and Ginsburg in intelligence, competence, or ethics. What separates them is judicial philosophy, ideology, and ideology means everything on the Supreme Court. Future justices will all likely be similarly qualified to meet the basic requirements of the job. It is their ideologies that will shape the court and thus the nation. And I think anybody who follows the Supreme Court, will agree that that's true. I mean, we'd like to think, you know, that these things are decided, you know, purely objectively and on the law. But in effect, that's not the way things work. So let me talk a little bit about the author, Jeffrey Tubin. He's, like most of these people who are appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, he is very talented academically. I mean, these people on the Supreme Court are brilliant people with brilliant degrees and brilliant careers right down the line. He likewise has a very brilliant career. He graduated near the top of his class from Harvard undergraduate and Harvard Law School. Like President Obama and most of the justices on the Supreme Court, he was one of the editors of the Law Review. He's on the Law Review staff, which is the high honor that you get probably to the top 15 or 20 students. He had experience as a staff attorney to an independent counsel investigation. He was a U.S. assistant attorney. He's a commentator for CNN, and he's written 5 books on interesting subjects. And actually, I'm going to go back and probably read some of his books, just because this one was kind of interesting. I mean, he writes a really good story. He's written one called Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. So that's going to get everybody's blood flowing and reading that one. And then when you get that one down, you've calmed down, you can go ahead and read A Vast Conspiracy, The Real Story of the Sex Scandal That Nearly Brought Down a President. You know what that's about. And then The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, which is kind of, lots been written about that. And then he talked about his first case, and apparently he was one of the prosecutors on the United States versus Oliver North case. So he's written some books, and he's a very good writer. Now I want to ask you, how many of you have read this book? Wow, we got lots of folks here who are going to be able to jump all over me on that if I make a mistake here. I have to be real careful. It's kind of like when you're a judge. Judge Cannell is here. He can appreciate this. But when you're trying a case and you're picking a jury and you get there and one lady raises or a man raises his hand and says, I teach English. It's like the whole rest of the trial, everybody is very careful because they want to make sure they've, you know, haven't misplaced a modifier or those kinds of things. And it takes a long time to write the jury instructions as well. Any of you read any of his other books? So raise your hand have read this book. Now, what I thought I would do is I think, you know, I don't know where, how attuned everybody is to the court system. I mean, I've sort of lived in it, so it's sort of second nature to me, but I thought I would kind of just spend a few minutes explaining kind of how this court system works, and I brought in some very expensive material to assist me, and basically what I want to do, I use cans of soup because I thought somebody would be eating lunch. It was a lunchtime thing. But basically, let's take these two cans of soup, and these represent, in fact, I'll even put them in a box so everybody can see. Forgive this box, but I've had it for a long time. In fact, if any of you ever remember Dr. Pfeffer, now see if anybody goes really back, Ray and Mary Pfeffer, this was Dr. Pfeffer's box. That's all I'll say. For those of you who know, great, great, great person. I'm going to let these two cans be trial courts. Now, right over in the courthouse, we have a trial court. Judge Cannell sits there as one of our three circuit court judges. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm glad. Thank you for that. I got to keep that real in mind. I'm going to take this with me just a second, and then I'll come back and use it. Okay. Judge Cannell sits in that court. And basically, that court decides just about everything. It gets decided at the first level. If there's a criminal case, if there's a civil lawsuit, a malpractice case, divorce cases, probate cases, everything gets decided there. And in Oregon, there are about 160 judges in various counties. Like Portland, you might have 35 judges. Lakeview, you have one. So I didn't have that many cans of soup, so you'll have to use your imagination. Okay? Then on top of that in Oregon, there is a court that we call Court of Appeals. There are 10 justices on there. And basically what happens down here is down here you hear live testimony, live bodies, and the judges and juries make the decisions. But if somebody feels the judge has made a mistake in a legal ruling, they can take that up to the Court of Appeals. So these courts all over the state, the 22 or 23 judicial districts that have all these judges, certain parties are appealing cases. They don't get a new trial. The trial proceedings are all taken down in a book. You start out with a court comes to session to the end of the trial, and these justices and their clerks read the book, and with the lawyers filing briefs to tell them what the errors are, they look to see if there are any errors. And if there are, they reverse the case. If they feel it's decided correctly, they affirm it. On top of this sits the Oregon Supreme Court. And the Oregon Supreme Court basically performs the same function as the Court of Appeals, only they only take very few cases. They sort of pick and choose what cases they will take. So if they think something's going to be a really an important issue, they'll take it. If they don't, they won't. So they hear very few cases, and of course their decisions are pretty important when they come out. They also, just by law, they have to hear all death penalty cases. That's something they don't have any choice in, but anybody who's given the death penalty has to. Now, in Oregon, we also have a completely separate system. I mean, it's not completely separate, but it is in a way. It's the federal system. And the federal system we have in Oregon, we have a federal district court. There are a number of judges, maybe half a dozen judges on the federal court. And they hear, just like our circuit judges do, disputes that involve federal issues. I mean, they can hear things about the environment. Lots of times when two corporations are suing each other, they do it in federal district court. On top of that is what we call the Federal Court of Appeals. And there are about 12 courts of appeals throughout the country. We're probably most familiar with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. And they take all the appeals from all these district courts all over the country, all over the Northwest, basically Alaska, Washington, and they make these same kind of legal decisions on the law. And then if someone's dissatisfied, they go up. I saved the biggest can of beans for the Supreme Court. They go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, again, only picks a few cases. I mean, there are thousands of cases that come to the Supreme Court, thousands of people who want to hear their cases heard by the Supreme Court. But they take very few, 30, 40, and they try to pick those that are of most importance. You might have two different circuit court judges, two different circuits in the country, maybe one for the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit are deciding some legal principle differently, and they've got to resolve that. And also they tend to take the big cases, abortion, death penalty, voting rights, gun control, free speech. They tend to get up there. And cases can get up there, obviously, this way, and they can also come up this way. Now, as a trial judge, I didn't really usually make very many constitutional issues. I mean, you can have one come to a trial judge. And I think at one point we had a Corvallis vagrancy law that somebody challenged as being unconstitutional. Well, a judge will rule on that, but that really goes up to these folks. And if it's important enough, it goes over to the U.S. Supreme Court. So they can take cases from state courts, or they can take cases from local courts. But they usually involve, you know, some pretty substantial issues. So I just wanted to kind of go over that because I think it's important to realize how important the Supreme Court is to the rest of the judicial system. I think that's obvious, but I wanted to point it out in some detail. And one of the things that I want to talk a little bit about, I'm going to make this real short because I want to get back to the book, but this he talks to quite a bit, is about the role of bias. And the dictionary definition of bias is a preference or an inclination, especially one that inhibits impartial judgment. And, you know, you cannot eliminate bias. I mean, it's there. As a judge, it's there. And I want to ask you a question. If you were a tenant and you were coming up before a judge to hear you're being evicted and you didn't claim you should be evicted and you knew that your judge had been a landlord before they became a judge and had lots of problems with tenants, lots of lawsuits, and there was another judge in the courthouse who'd been a tenant, you know, and been in legal aid and represent a lot of tenants, I mean, who would you rather have to hear your case? Okay, yeah, okay, right. And so, you know, judges sort of fight this, but it's there. And then, you know, and then there's another aspect to this, which I don't like to call bias because that sort of cheapens things a little bit. But I think a lot of it is just your particular worldview. I mean, how can you decide abortion based on anything other than your worldview or death penalty cases? I mean, it's just how you view life or how you view, you know, it's just they're just things that are part of us, and you can't eliminate those from decisions. Now, what the legislature tries to do occasionally is they try to say, well, look, we're not going to let these biased people or judges make decisions. We're going to make the law very specific. And what they've done, like in landlord-tenant cases, for example, is they say, if the landlord doesn't give a notice within 3 days, and it's spelled out very specifically, then the landlord can't evict the tenant. And so therefore, even though you have a case where the landlord's been a wonderful person, this tenant's been a jerk, you know, and the landlord finally gives them the notice, but it's only, you know, 2 days and 23 hours, and the landlord loses. You get some injustice, but there's no bias. And the bigger you open the door to allow individual bias and to right individual wrongs in a particular case, then of course, you have more bias. So if it says the landlord is entitled to give reasonable notice, then if you have a judge who's biased maybe on one side, reasonable means one thing and reasonable means the other. And I think, you know, in fairness, being a judge, you try to fight the bias issue. And you really like it sometimes when you have a law that you really can't wiggle with. But the reality is bias plays a big role, and particularly in areas in the Supreme Court. So let me move on then, and I want to ask anybody if they have any questions at this point. Okay, good. Now, let's talk something about the book and things that I found interesting, really interesting about the book. And the first thing is the appointment process, and John Byrne referred to that. And it is an amazing process. I mean, I can't go back in history and tell you how it was done then, but right now, I mean, they spend a lot of time vetting these people to see how they're going to perform on the Supreme Court. And one of the things that Toobin points out in his book is that in the past, the president and his staff have made some mistakes. In other words, they picked people who, when they got on the court, sort of turned out different than they would expect it. In fact, David Souter was appointed by a Republican president, and he turned out to be sort of with the liberal majority most of his time. But recently, the stakes have become so high and our partisanship so great that the vetting process is so complete that Toobin's theory is that what you see is what you're going to get from now. I mean, the president's going to know when he appoints somebody how they're pretty much going to vote. And the interesting thing, one of the interesting things to me about the Supreme Court is that every single member of the Supreme Court has had the same occupation, not just lawyer, obviously, before they were appointed. Anybody knows what that was, what their job was, what their title was? Every single justice of the Supreme Court.
They came up through the appeals court.
Yeah. Every one of them has been in this position right here. This blue. They've all been federal court of appeals judges. Now, some of them have had long tenure on the federal court of appeals. Stephen Breyer was on there quite a long time, and he was actually the chief justice of the Court of Appeals that's based in Boston. Others, like I think Clarence Thomas, got appointed 1 year to the D.C. Circuit before he was elevated to the Supreme Court. But they've all been on that. And, of course, one of the reasons that Toobin says they're looking to – who can tell me why you think they would like to have – look at judges who've been on the Federal Court of Appeals?
They're already been.
They can tell what you're going to get.
Right. They've written all these opinions. They've been on there for 10 years, and they've written all these opinions, and so you have a pretty good idea of how they are going to rule. Now, there's a caveat to that that I think, because, first of all, I mean, I don't know how this is going to be, but if you were a top graduate of our law schools and you really aimed for the Supreme Court, I think you would duck every issue. You got an abortion case, I mean, you'd get the flu or something and not be there to decide it because you just couldn't get appointed. I mean, you know, take a guy like Toobin. I mean, he's a very brilliant guy with a brilliant history. He could never be appointed to the Supreme Court, at least our present climate, because he's sort of stated his views on issue. And that's sort of what everybody wants to do is, when they go before Congress, is not to be able to be pinned down on a particular view. So you end up with these very long search processes and, in fact, you know, a number of people being disqualified along the way for reasons that we might think are trivial, till eventually they come up with somebody that they think can get through the system. And that's not to say, you know, that they're picking, you know, political hacks to take these positions. I mean, these people aren't that. They're very brilliant. They're, you know, very respected jurists. It's just that that's the reality of the process. Let's see, there's a quote. I already read that to you. So I won't read that again. Okay. I mentioned before, these folks are very accomplished academically. They're just a top of their class. Justice Stevens, who's the oldest member of the Supreme Court, I think at 89, he recorded the highest grade ever recorded in law school at the Northwestern Law School. They all had brilliant careers. The interesting thing to me I found was there are 9 Supreme Court justices, and 6 of them graduated from either Harvard or Yale Law School. That's kind of interesting. And most more from Harvard than Yale. I think 2 from Yale, two or three from Yale, but more from Harvard. And as I said, all of them served as U.S. Court of Appeals judges immediately before their appointment, and several of them served on what most people think is the most important circuit court of appeals, which is the D.C. Circuit, sits in Washington. It has a very small geographic area, but a lot of the federal issues, legislation, challenges to Congress come up through the D.C. Court of Appeals. And so a number of people that are appointed were raised to the Supreme Court from that position. The next thing I found real interesting is the number of interactions and connections there are between these folks. I mean, you take the whole United States and all the lawyers in the United States, I mean, you just wouldn't think that these people would run into each other. But it turns out there's an awful lot of connections. I mean, they've either clerked for another Supreme Court judge and then went to the law, you know, their career and became a Supreme Court justice. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist. Now, of course, Roberts was out of law school, and he clerked, and then he became Chief Justice. I don't know whether many of you know this, but apparently Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor were longtime friends. They both graduated from Stanford Law School. Rehnquist was the valedictorian, and I think O'Connor was a couple of years behind. She was like number three in the class. They both ended up in Phoenix. They became friends. They had parties. They took family vacations together, and they ended up together on the Supreme Court. That's a tremendous coincidence. The other thing is the interactions between the justices. You know, I've always thought I've never really served as an appellate judge, and once in a while, it would be sort of a terrible thing. Actually, I hate to say this, but you're sitting there with a bunch of other people who all have strong opinions, and you have to reach a decision in a room. And I could see where that would be really difficult, you know. But apparently, despite this, and despite, you know, some of the personalities on the Supreme Court, and obviously these people have huge egos. I mean, you don't get there without having a huge ego. I mean, they seem to get along, according to Tubin, very well. I mean, somehow they have developed this collegiality and respect, and they don't yell at each other, and they get along reasonably well, which says something, I think, for how well the process works. They do have I was curious to how much they really talked, and apparently they don't chat together very much during the week. They do a lot of communicating between their law clerks. They all have three or four law clerks, and these law clerks do the communicating. It's a little softer to send your law clerk down to another judge's law clerk to try to get an agreement on an issue. And they all picked their law clerks differently, in different ways. They always said Chief Justice Rehnquist, apparently he picked his law clerks for brilliance and scholarliness, but they also had to play tennis because he needed to have three tennis players for a doubles game. Hard to believe, but that's the way it works. Another thing I didn't know is that they do have a weekly lunch. And when Rehnquist was the Chief Justice, and apparently the same practice continues now, they can't talk about legal cases, which if you've ever been in a group of lawyers, I mean, that's impossible. I don't care what you do. They always drift off into legal, but they can't do it. And so, as I said in the book, they got tired very quick of talking about their grandkids and vacations. So they started inviting people to their lunch. And so they've had Condoleezza Rice, Greenspan, all your leading figures across the spectrum come and have lunch with them and talk. Nobody knows what they talk about, but they do interact with these folks. They have a couple of conferences per week where they consider what kind of cases they're going to take and how they're going to vote. And they do a lot of communications, you know, through writing, emails and writing. But they're not just sitting there every day talking to each other. One of the things that kind of gives you an idea of how they do things there, which is kind of a surprise to me, was I'm going to put this up here and read this from the book or summarize it. It's a little bit long. But anyway, when Justice Alito was appointed, they had a welcoming dinner for him. And all the justices were there. And so Justice Breyer was going to be the master of ceremonies. And they had this dinner at the Great Hall of the Court. And as I say, the retired judges were there, Thurgood Marshall, Potter Stewart, Sandra O'Connor. And Breyer stood up and said, "We're very happy to have this dinner for you, Justice Alito, but I have to warn you about something. Everyone here tonight is very nice to you. but they'll turn on you. They'll dissent from your opinions. They won't sign on to your dissents. It's a tough group. At that point, according to him, in the flickering light of the candelabras, the guests exchanged puzzled looks. "What you need here is a friend," Breyer went on. "You need someone who will stand by you, really stand by you, not like these people around the table." Now, you have to remember that Alioto was born in Trenton, New Jersey. He's a great Phillies fan. And at this moment, the door to the dining room swung open, and a giant beast with green fur, purple eyelashes, and a Philadelphia Phillies jersey burst into the room. The Philly fanatic, mascot of Alito's beloved baseball team, lumbered over to Alito, gave him a prolonged embrace, and then left the room, leaving laughter in his wake. So it shows, you know, despite the intensity of these folks' feelings, I mean, they do have a sense of humor, and they do get along, and they do respect each other. I mean, like Alioto goes to Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg's house for dinner. I mean, you can imagine two more conflicting personalities, you know, but there they are. They, you know. Let me go to the next one. The next thing was impressed me was the respect that all the judges had for Chief Justice Rehnquist. And I guess in part of this was due to that he succeeded Justice Berger, who apparently was very unpopular with the other justices. He was sort of arrogant and big on buildings and ceremony and very controlling. And he's not very well liked by the justices. And Rehnquist, when he took over, he became apparently very fair. He conducted the conferences differently. He, you know, let other people write opinions. He just was very even-handed, and even those who were on the other end of the political spectrum respected him. And there was apparently when he died in office, there was a real genuine outpouring of faith, but confidence and loss with the other courts. Incidentally, one of his pallbearers was now Chief Justice Roberts. He spends a lot of time in the book about the two swing people on the court. Now, I gave you that sheet, and maybe I'll go over that at this time. I did this because it's kind of tough to tell the characters when you're sitting here, because I had to kind of follow this. I mean, we don't all follow the Supreme Court. But basically what I've done is I've grouped these kind of the way he would group them, and there are no particular reason to where I put these people except one or two. And one is that I put what we call the more conservative judges at the top, and that would be Alito, Scalia, Thomas, and Roberts. Then I put what we call the swing people in the middle, and they're people that go sort of with one side one time, other side the next time, Kennedy, who's now on the court, and O'Connor, who was, but she's retired. And then the bottom I put people on what you consider the other more liberal end of the spectrum, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Stevens, and Breyer. Under that, I put their age, because that's obviously a really significant thing. I mean, you talk about replacing people. I mean, who's going to retire? One thing I found really interesting, I guess it's fairly logic, is that some of these justices wanted to retire, but they wouldn't retire because they wanted to wait for the right administration to be in place. So, I mean, they kind of had this, it's not only I did my job and I'm leaving, it's I did my job and I'm leaving, but I want to make sure that somebody comes in who's going to think the way I do or think close to the way I do. Mike, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's good. Thank you for reminding me. I forget that. I should be really aware of that because I wear hearing aids myself, but I forget sometimes. Forgive me. So you can see, if you take a look at the top list, you see Alito is just appointed. He's 59. He's going to be there for a long time. When you look at the oldest judge is 89, is Stevens. Scalia is 73. Thomas is 62. And Roberts is 54. So they're relatively young. Then you have Kennedy, who's 73. That's still relatively young. He's the swing person right now. He's pretty clearly a swing person. Ginsburg has health issues. She's 76. Sotomayor is 55. She's very young. Justice Stevens is 89. And Breyer is age 71. And below it, I put who appointed them. And I put who they replaced if it was a recent replacement. I didn't go back in history. So you can kind of look at that and see generally, you know, where everybody stands. But anyway, he talks a lot about the swing people, Kennedy and O'Connor, and particularly a lot about O'Connor. And he has a great, tremendous amount of respect for this justice. O'Connor, and I didn't realize this, but she was a very active in politics in her home state. She actually became the majority leader of the Senate. Very active socially. I mean, she even apparently now, I guess, but when she was on the court, she and her husband would go to parties all the time. Very, very outgoing, active, interested in things. She then got appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court. And then from there, she went to the Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court. But she was basically had some fairly conservative views, but she had some very strong views about certain things, and she was very concerned about public opinion, not taking the court out to areas and issuing decisions that would be adverse to public opinion, and pretty firm and effective justice. So he has a lot of respect for her. And I think, you know, like in the abortion issue, she although she was appointed by a Republican, she was a Republican, she did not believe that abortion should be illegal, but she did feel that states could regulate abortion provided they didn't do anything that would interfere with the health of the mother. And so that was a position that she took, and she was quite influential in preventing the court at times from maybe overruling Roe versus Wade or really making some real inroads, but on the other hand, she was allowing some regulation. He's kind of torn because I think Tubin, because he really likes her, but she was the swing vote in the Bush versus Gore case. I mean, she's the one that made it 5-4. So, and he has difficulty with that, but he can accept. But she's an interesting, very interesting person. And the other thing that she points out that's really kind of a sad thing was that she had sort of she didn't want to retire when she did, but her husband had Alzheimer's and she was kind of trying to deal with his situation. They'd been married, you know, their whole lives, and she just felt she had an obligation to be with him, and so she resigned, retired, and he died shortly thereafter. And apparently, she was just devastated because she did not, you know, she didn't really want to leave the court, and she was not all very happy about the appointment, which was. I always call him Alioto. I'll never forget. I don't know why I always do that. Alito. She was not very pleased about his appointment. So her retirement. But I read in the paper she's very active these days. I mean, she's been written up recently where she's out promoting. I think she came to Oregon. Some issues. Then just to run through a few others that might be of interest to you. I'm going to leave you time for questions. You can maybe direct me if I'm dealing with more with issues that I'm not dealing with issues that you think I should. But one other one is Clarence Thomas. He's kind of an interesting person. All these people are pretty interesting. But he's a Yale Law graduate. He held some high government positions. He was appointed to the D.C. Court of Appeals. Very conservative, obviously. But the interesting thing is apparently he's sort of two different personae. In the court, he's very popular. And it said that, this is the quote, he's ideologically isolated from the rest of the justices, but universally adored by other justices, law clerks, and the staff. He's kind of noted for his kindness. Apparently, he and his wife, you know, have somebody sick, you know, or somebody who's in the hospital. I mean, he shows up. And the other thing that's really interesting in his personal life, nobody would ever guess this man's hobbies. Anybody know what his hobbies are? RVs, there. What's the other one, though?
I don't know.
NASCAR races. Yeah. And so he's kind of the two different people because in the court and among his friends, he's apparently just a likable, jovial, roaring laughter kind of a guy. But publicly, he's very reserved. He has great distrust of the press. And he's one of the few judges that rarely, if ever, asks a question. Apparently, in the past, the justices didn't ask very many questions, but now they do more. But he went a whole term without asking a single question, just a little different from the other judges. The other one that was kind of interesting to me was David Souter, who resigned recently. And, in fact, Sotomayor was his replacement. And he was an interesting guy because they sort of portray him as a loner, but he couldn't have been that much of a loner because he, well, of course, he had a brilliant education career, He went to Harvard, then he got, a PhD from Oxford, then he graduated from Harvard Law, but he became the New Hampshire Attorney General. Then he was on the Supreme Court of New Hampshire, and then he was appointed to the Federal Court of Appeals. But he was kind of a bit of an oddball, I think. I mean, everybody's entitled to their eccentricities, but he would keep the lights off in his office. This is all according to Toobin. I mean, I haven't been there, so I don't. He would keep the lights off in his office. No one really knew why, and he would shift his chair around to capture the daylight. I don't know what he did if he had. Obviously, he had to read at night or something. He also ate the same lunch every day, and I don't want to embarrass anybody who eats the same lunch. I normally eat the same lunch every day in the summer, tomato and lettuce, but I don't know. But he would read. His lunch was one apple, including the core of the seeds, core and the seeds, and one cup of yogurt. And apparently the other justices, many of them would eat in the cafeteria, but he would eat in his office, and it always was served to him on a silver tray from the cafeteria. He was very well-liked. Actually, he and Thomas were probably the two most personable people on the court. He was just very well-liked, very decent guy. And he did not like Washington, D.C. In fact, some of you may remember that he was actually mugged in Washington, beaten up, went to the emergency room in Washington, D.C. Did not like that, obviously. He to this day, the day he retired, he wrote out his decisions with a fountain pen. I mean, that's a little unusual, you know, in this day and age with computers and word processors. He actually was very wealthy, according to his disclosures. I don't know how they came down. Well, I don't know how he ever filed this kind of a disclosure form, but he's worth between $2.5 and $25 million. So how you figure that out? Maybe it's the stock market. Maybe they took it during the... Anyway, and apparently the Supreme Court justices get a lot of gifts. And some of them report as high as $30,000 or $40,000 in gifts a year. I mean, these would be like plaques if they go talk to some group. And he never accepted any gifts, and he rarely traveled. Now, Chief Justice Roberts, just a few things about him. He sort of has it all. I mean, if you had to take somebody that has the background, I mean, he was a top graduate of Harvard Law. He was the chief editor of the Law Review. He had a very successful law practice with a large firm dealing in constitutional cases, so he was argued before the Supreme Court many times. And apparently he's a very personable guy and gets along really well with the other justices and sort of carrying on Rehnquist's tradition of sort of giving everybody their opportunity to speak and so forth. I was talking about travel, that Souter didn't travel. But lots of these other judges, they travel like crazy. And I remember years ago I read a book by William Douglas, who's a Supreme Court. He was originally born in Yakima, and I think he actually had a place out here in eastern Oregon somewhere. But he wrote in this book that he remained on the Supreme Court all these years because it was the only place he knew where he could have his summers completely off. And they do. I mean, they basically argue their case and they leave and they come back like in September or October and they've got the summer off. But the interesting thing to me is that these folks travel like crazy. I think Kennedy is sort of the most traveled. And they go over to Europe. They're called to, you know, they give speeches and they go to, there's a place in Salzburg where apparently all the judges in Europe get together and they have seminars. And they do a lot of traveling. Now, this has kind of an interesting little footnote or impact on the court because you probably heard the justices are criticized because in some of their opinions they refer to what's going on in Europe. Like if you're talking about capital punishment, they might note that none of the countries in Europe have capital punishment. Or they might refer to juvenile. There was a case up to the Supreme Court about whether juveniles could be executed. They held they couldn't, and in that they referred to that in Europe and other parts of the world, they don't do those kind of things. So that travel has had a great impact on the judges because they're out there in other countries, other legal cultures during the summer, and then they're coming back and, you know, obviously they're absorbing something. I can't see how it can be harmful. I mean, it's just part of life's experience. But I was just amazed at how much traveling they do. Now, Souter used to go back to his place in New Hampshire and, I guess, think about things and kind of relax, which would sort of be my choice, I suppose, if I was ever in that position. But these folks apparently like to travel. Because of this split that I've laid out on the sheet that you have, I mean, a lot of the decisions on the big issues are 5-4 decisions. So if you have four that are pretty much voting this way and four that are pretty much voting this way, the person in the middle has all the power, and that's Kennedy. And Kennedy is sort of an interesting person because they kind of portray – Tubman portrays him as sort of being vain, somebody who loves to be in the spotlight, and he's just as happy as a clam right now because he controls the ball game. I mean, in some of these issues, I mean, he really does have tremendous control over what happens. I've got some other comments on the other judges. I'm going to make them really, really quick because I want to leave 10 minutes for questions, and we're almost there. I mentioned about John Paul Stevens. He's the oldest justice. He sort of falls on the liberal side. The interesting thing was that he's the justice that's ultimately responsible for the Clinton scandal because he passed he gave the vote and wrote the opinion that required President Clinton to defend the Paula Jones lawsuit. If you recall, Paula Jones had filed a lawsuit against Clinton for sexual harassment, and President Clinton's argument was you shouldn't have the president who's trying to run the world defending these lawsuits. And Justice Stevens, in kind of an interesting opinion, says, well, you're not all that busy. Defend it. Which is kind of interesting. And so anyway, at the end result, well, there was a deposition taken in that lawsuit, and that's where the perjured testimony took place that led to the ultimate thing. The other thing about Stevens, I mentioned that he served in wartime with Walt Hopkins, who was locally, but he decided recently one of the Guantanamo cases, and he's very big on limiting the authority of government, and he either attributed in that opinion or in his comments that his wartime experience in intelligence, he was an intelligence officer in the South Pacific, was responsible for the way he felt about government. He his work in intelligence. He actually received a Navy commendation or some award because he apparently had helped zero in through intelligence when the planes caught the Japanese Admiral Yamamoto in the Pacific. He was cited for that. We talked about just see if there's any others here that would jump. I'm not going to say very much about Sotomayor because she's been in news so much lately. Everybody knows pretty much about her background. And Stephen Breyer, I'd mentioned to him, he also has a brilliant law career, and he's a very affable, effective justice. He was actually on the staff of Ted Kennedy for quite a while, was the chief legal counsel. He's apparently pretty good about trying to get people to work together and building coalitions. But he would never have made it except about five people dropped out before he got the position. They offered the position first to Mario Cuomo, who declined. Then George Mitchell, the distinguished senator who's been involved in so many peace efforts, he declined. And then there were two or three others that were disqualified for some reason, one for ill health and one because they had a housekeeper or something, you know, that they hadn't paid taxes on and so forth. So that sort of gets us there. So I guess what I would conclude is that, you know, bias and worldview are really important. I mean, you can't decide death penalty on the law. Where's the law on death penalty? I mean, there isn't. Where's the law on abortion? I mean, there isn't. You have to decide that on sort of your worldview. So when presidents are picking justice, they want to get people who will agree with their worldview. That's just the realities. And that's why we have such contentious hearings, and they're probably going to continue to be contentious in the future. But I think, you know, to moderate against that is the fact that these folks have all come up through the legal community and legal community and worked in that. And so they all seem to have a very respect for the law. They have a respect for their position. They seem to get along well and respect each other. And they do have respect for decisions, that principle, in verbis stare decisis, not overturning decisions. I mean, the Supreme Court overturns them, their own decisions. Some of them within 20 years they overturn them. But they only do it with great reluctance. And so that's, I think, an important factor that sort of moderates how these justices work. And as I say, this group has a great impact on decisions. I mean, there's two cases that they decided that aren't even mentioned in this book, but they were decided, and Judge Cannell will know about these too, is that one of them was a sentencing. In Oregon, we used to have these rules that if someone was convicted, let's say, of assault, then the judge could find aggravating factors and give them more time. Like maybe it was a disabled person, you could aggravate it. And this has been going on for years. And somebody took this up to the Supreme Court, and I said, no, you can't do that. The jury has to do that. And so suddenly you've got thousands and thousands of cases all over the United States, people in prison, and all those things. They're still sorting that out. And then they did another thing right after that that limited hearsay, the use of hearsay. And the same thing, had huge changes in legal process. There are ones that don't even make their radar screen except among judges that have tremendous impact. So I'm getting the signal. He's about to come down. He's got a little club back there for me. So thanks again for letting me come here and talk to you. And I'll be here. I can answer a few questions, provided they're very non-controversial and easy. And then I'll stick around afterwards if anybody has any. Your hand was up first, sir. I'm always a little leery of the. I'm a little leery of the first hand up, but I'll go ahead and take it anyway.
Well, this is sort of just a worldview question. I swear if Tubman ever talks about it, because all of the justices on the conservative side are Catholic. And Sotomayor is going to be the first Catholic on the liberal side. So I just wonder if Tubman ever talks about their religion.
No, he might mention it a couple times, but that's not really, he didn't really give that. Kennedy's the swing votes, he's Catholic, yeah.
You've got six Catholics. Yeah. Before Sotomayor, they were all on.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
He said they sold.
Yeah. Yes?
Could you just address us his opinions of Scalia?
Well, Scalia is kind of a, you know, everybody thinks Scalia is, I mean, the sort of the reaction on the court is, I think he quotes Ginsburg at one time when somebody says something outrageous that Scalia did, and she says, oh, that's just, they call him Momo or something. That's just Momo. I mean, he's just that kind of a guy, you know. I mean, and that's the way the court seems to react to him. I mean, he, you know, obviously he's very, he has a very conservative view. I mean, he believes in original intent, you know, go back to the Constitution. I mean, I agree with some of the things, but I don't think you can go back, and I just don't think you can do that myself practically. I mean, I think the classic reason you can't is you can read a book by a great scholar who tells you that it's okay if you have prayers in school because Benjamin Franklin and you name it, and they did those things at that time. You can go read another book over here by a great scholar who says, no, these people didn't want to have any religion. You can't do it. You just can't do it. And so to go back and to try to evaluate gun control based on, you know, what happened back in the 1770s, realities in 1770s. You can't do it. So, anyway, but he's a brilliant guy, but obviously he's feisty and tactless.
Because these have come up through the Federal Court of Appeals, how do the people get appointed to the Federal Court of Appeals? Is that also part of the worldview of whoever does that?
Right, and they have to be approved by Congress. So there is quite a bit. You know, you've heard, you know, that Clinton appointees were for the district and circuit courts were kind of waiting to be confirmed. And so that's what happens is they're vetting these people to the Congress. They're vetting these people and they're eliminating. I think that Roberts, I think he waited a couple of years. I don't think he got confirmed maybe the first time. So, I mean, there are some of these people who have been through the process and didn't get to the Court of Appeals on their first time.
So it's the president actually did that.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I've been struck listening to confirmation hearings how hard they try to keep up the pretense that all these things are decided objectively by just pure legal logic.
Yeah.
It's so obviously not true, but what is the function of keeping up the pretense that they do?
Well, I think that's a lot of, you know, you try to keep it high-minded, you know. It's just like, you know, you have, you know, people, they were not, you know, you're pointing people who aren't going to tell you what their views are unless you can discern them. And I think everybody wants to put everything on a higher plane. That's the reason, I think. You know, you don't want to seem like you're partisan, but, I mean, you are. So you say, well, you try to think of some other reason for attacking somebody. Yeah. Yes?
Roberts, who was the newest and youngest Supreme Court, became the Chief Justice. How did that work?
Well, the President makes the appointment. And actually, he was, as I recall what happened, he was going to be appointed to the Supreme Court to fill O'Connor's position. Then Rehnquist died, and then he was appointed. But he was appointed by the President. The President appoints the Chief Justice. And that's a pretty...
It's not somebody who's already on the...
No, it's just...
Transferred in or anything.
No, and the president could appoint somebody on the court, or he could appoint somebody new.
It's just his decision.
Just his decision. And, I think there's only been, I can't remember, it's either 13 or 16 chief justices in the whole history of the United States. So they tend to serve a long time. Yes, sir, Dr. Lerner.
There was perhaps not as much stability as usual, but 2000, is what does Tubin say about the 2000 debacle, you know, when they had to decide who was president?
I could say that you should read his book about that. But it's very hard to sort out because you'd really have to, because it's very, a lot of things were happening in a short period of time. I mean, you had the, you know, I mean, he does admit that the Florida Supreme Court made some big mistakes, that it was very partisan, the whole thing. And he feels very strongly that the Supreme Court should not have gotten involved in that. And actually, there was a case at that time pending in the Court of Appeals that would have, if it was affirmed by the Supreme Court, would have come out with the same result. But the Supreme Court kind of, instead of waiting for everything to come up here, they jumped into it. It was sort of like this panic kind of a thing almost. You know, they had to do something or there was going to be some big crisis. But, I mean, he thinks that it was a terrible mistake and you know, so forth. So, you know, I really want to read it. I have to read some books on it to really give you an opinion because I think you could read, you really need to read both sides. I think there's probably a little of both. Yes, ma'am. Okay, the question was about the travel that the justice has taken and how that impacts them. What is the negative reaction? The negative reaction was that some people feel, well, this is the U.S. of A., and we shouldn't be quoting decision from a judge in Germany or judges in Germany. Now, people may disagree or agree with that, but, I mean, that's the basis of it, just depending upon, you know, where your political outcome is, A, come out on that. So, yes, sir.
I was struck in the book by how much subjectivity there is in making these decisions. There's personal biases involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is that only in the Supreme Court, or does that filter all the way down?
No, I think it does. I mean, you know, it depends what you're dealing with, obviously. If you're dealing with death penalty, abortion, there's a huge amount and very little law. But if you come down, as you come down the level and you get down to the courts and you're dealing with less, because there is law, specific law that you're applying. Also, you know, when you get in the lower court, a lot of these important decisions are decided by juries, 12 people with different biases or world experiences, and they kind of pound it out, and hopefully you come out with the right decision. And I always think that, I'm going to end it with this, but I always think the classic case for me that brought this home to me was O.J. Simpson. Because let's assume you have a fact, and sometimes you can even get biased about whether something's a fact. I mean, if a police officer says he ran the red light, if you had a bad experience with police officers, your bias may incline you to say, I don't believe it. Okay? But, I mean, let's assume we have a fact. Like, let's assume everybody could agree there was a bloody glove found on the driveway of O.J. Simpson's home. Now, you have to draw, that's just a fact. You have to draw an inference from that to show that that's somehow relevant to this murder prosecution. And some people said, that's very relevant because he dropped it. I mean, that's what happens. People go back, they drop it. But other people said, no, that was planted by the police because I think some of those people in that worldview, because of their experiences or whatever, were more likely to believe that police would do that kind of thing than other people. So there is an example of one fact, and you reach two totally different conclusions, not on the law, but based on what your prior experiences were and your bias. You know, you try to eliminate that, but you can never eliminate it. But as I say, the jury system is good in that you get 12 people up there and you kind of even it out, hopefully. As one other thing, I can't resist this. Deborah's going to shoot me, but one of the hardest things to do in jury, I know you have one, Judge, but is to get a case where a car has hit a bicyclist. Because how do you pick a jury in this town? I mean, it's really terrible. You know, you get somebody, what do you think of drivers? What do you think of bicyclists? You know? And you struggle, and you finally end up with, you know, maybe three bicyclists and 9 car drivers and you send them in a room. But they're going to interpret things a lot differently. Because if you're a driver and you've had a bike pull out in front of you at nighttime, or you're a biker and you've been driving and somebody's almost clipped you, you have a different view of things, even the facts. So I'll stick around if anybody has any questions. Thanks again for coming.